Those of you joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what we have coming up next and future shows. And if you have a show idea for us, you can always let us know. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. And we want to hear from you for this next segment here. Do you have loved ones in prison? Do you have ideas about how we can reform our criminal justice system in the United States, particularly for repeat offenders and for expecting mothers, and what we should be doing about prisoners who are about to give birth or have just given birth? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. So let's talk now about two powerful documentaries on the criminal justice system and life in prison in the U.S. Two Strikes, a film produced with the Marshall Project and Firelight Media, examines the impact of Florida's little-known Two Strikes law. And the documentary tells the story of how a former West Point cadet struggling with mental illness and alcoholism got life in prison in Florida after an attempted carjacking, a sentence that even the victim viewed as too harsh. And Tutwiler tells the story of expectant mothers behind bars at Alabama's Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women and what happens to their newborns. Two Strikes and Tutwiler are streaming on Frontline's website, Frontline's YouTube channel, and the PBS app. And we're very pleased to be joined by Elaine McMillian Sheldon, an Academy Award nominated, Peabody winning, and two-time Emmy winning documentary filmmaker and the director of Tutwiler. Good to have you with us, Elaine.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Ursula Liang, who is the director and producer of Two Strikes. She is an award-winning director and producer with 25 years of experience in storytelling. Ursula, thank you for joining us on Your Call.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's great to have you both, and thank you for this really important work. Each of these documentaries looks at systemic problems with existing criminal justice systems, even though they look at two different prison populations. But they do have similarities with Two Strikes, as I mentioned, examining Florida's two-strike law. And according to the Marshall Project, that state has far more people serving life without parole than any other state, almost a quarter of the total nationwide in 2021. And so Tutwiler looks at this punitive aspect of the two strikes law. And then Tutwiler, as I mentioned, talks about the women's prison in Alabama. So Elaine, I wanted to start with you and Tutwiler. How did you come to focus on this particular women's prison in Alabama?
Sure. Well, I'm an independent documentary filmmaker, and the story came to me from Frontline and Alicia Santo at the Marshall Project. Alicia has covered criminal justice as a reporter for many, many years, and Alabama's Tutwiler prison is pretty notorious. It's its oldest prison. It's the only maximum security prison for women. It's home to the state's female death row. And in 2014, the Justice Department led an investigation that claimed Tutwiler was a toxic, sexualized environment, stating that their investigation had more than a third of the staff had had sex with incarcerated women. And so Alicia was aware of this troubled history, and she was aware of what they were doing to make changes. So they were installing security cameras, they were hiring more female officers, and they had enacted this new doula program, which specifically addressed the health and safety of the women who come in incarcerated, who come in pregnant when incarcerated. And so we were able to film over 40 days in 2018 and 2019 following that doula program and the women that are involved.
Well, it's just amazing footage that you got. Ursula, I wanted to ask you about Two Strikes, titled after a law by the same name. You tell the story of Mark Jones, a former West Point cadet who had been struggling with multiple issues in his life, ended up getting life in prison, as I mentioned. How did you learn about Mark's case?
Well, again, this was a collaboration with the Marshall Project. So this reporter, Carrie Aspinwall, had written about Mark's case. And it really struck me because his case is one of those that touches a lot of the systems that are in play in Florida. It, you know, touches the military, touches the carceral system, it touches politics, touches rehabilitation for addicts. And so I was really drawn to his story. And in particular, the fact that so many nonviolent offenders were getting caught up in this law. You're right that Florida does have the largest number of lifers serving in the U.S., almost a quarter. And you know, the law was put into place to capture the most violent criminals. And Mark's offense did not seem like it was really, you know, the sentencing didn't really seem like it was playing out in the way that legislators had hoped. So we really wanted to take a closer look at it.
One thing that struck me about both of the films that you made here is the access that you got to prisoners and to the prison system. And I'd love to hear from you both just how that process worked. And Elaine, maybe I can start with you on that. How was it get for you getting access to these prisoners and this footage that you're able to get?
Yeah, well, the first line of credit goes to Alicia, who made the first trip down in 2018 to visit the prison and to visit the doula classes, and was able to talk to the wardens and the state corrections department to all sort of get them on board with the idea of us coming in with cameras. The access was fairly open, to be honest. They were really collaborative in the sense that, you know, it was Alicia and I, the only two people that were in the prison. I ran cameras, she ran sound, and we were welcome to document the things associated with the doula project. Obviously, there's things that go down inside the prison they didn't want us to see and were often very cautious about us seeing. But the access and cooperation, I think, was mostly granted because they had such a troubled past with this investigation in 2014 that they were wanting to show potentially that they were trying to change things. Also, they have hopes and dreams of, you know, this is the oldest prison in Alabama. They have hopes and dreams of having a setup where actually mothers and babies can live together in the future and not be separated. And so I think they sort of granted us the access with the hope that it would lead to a furthering of the program. However, we did not have cooperation with the hospital where the women deliver. And that became something that we had to work around.
Well, it's certainly a heartbreaking story, Elaine, of Tutwiler. And we have a lot we can talk about that. But it is good to know. It was good to see that at least there are plans to try to remedy that situation. And we could talk about that in a bit. But Ursula, I wanted to ask you a similar question about how it was for you to get access, particularly when the story that you're covering of the two strikes law and its impact on people is not a flattering one to the criminal justice system in Florida.
Well, I was part of the fellowship with Firelight Media and Frontline to support filmmakers of color exploring investigative and deeply reported stories. And I had never done a prison interview before. So Carrie Aspinwall, the reporter for the Marshall Project, helped me sort of line up all the ducks in terms of accessing the press department in Florida. And they were very cordial, but we were guaranteed 1 hour exactly. And we were, you know, I'm used to filmmaking in a very different way. We had to really cut back what we brought into the prison. We really scaled back. I had one person with me. We kept submitting lists of equipment that we wanted because we wanted good lighting. We wanted to have the right recording equipment. And we just kept stripping it back and stripping it back. And, you know, and Carrie actually ultimately, it was also a difficult process because we weren't given access, you know, a date 2 months in advance so we could prepare all this stuff. We were sort of given access and we had to be ready to jump. And I was a new mom and a single mom living in New York trying to film in Florida sort of at the drop of a hat. And that was sort of challenging for me. And at the last minute, actually, we were, our access became sort of thrown into conflict because they had noticed that one of the photos that was used in Carrie Aspinwall's original article in the Marshall Project showed a tiny bit of the window of the prison, and the rules in the prison were that you can't show any of the exterior of the prison. I think they see it as a security risk that this might help inmates escape. And so she was supposed to be there with us helping hold the microphone and sort of building our two-person team into something a little more substantial. And so ultimately she sort of sacrificed herself and cut herself off from the project, and our interview went forward. And you know, it was one of these things where I would have hoped she was there because she had a relationship with Mark. She had sat down with him before. And here I am, a new person coming into the prison, not knowing him. And trying to build a relationship with it, you know, within the 5 minutes that we're setting up in order to have a thoughtful and meaningful interview with him about something very serious in his life. And that was hard to do in such a short period of time. You know, not only that, but when we were interviewing him, you know, you see him in front of the camera in this cavernous space behind him, which is actually the cafeteria. And behind me are, you know, about 15 prison personnel. So I thought it was really challenging in terms of developing a relationship with him in that shorter period of time. And so, you know, for me, it was a new experience.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly difficult, but it's amazing what you pulled off. I would not have guessed those conditions were in place just based on watching the documentary. If you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're joined by Elaine McMillian Sheldon, Academy Award nominated, Peabody winning, and two-time Emmy winning documentary filmmaker and director of Tutwiler. And we're also joined by Ursula Leung, director and producer of Two Strikes, an award-winning director and producer with 25 years of experience in storytelling. And we want to hear from you too. If you have loved ones in prison, if you have thoughts about criminal justice reform, or if you've seen the documentaries and would like to comment on what you saw or ask questions of the filmmakers, you can drop us a line at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, let's dive into the stories here that both of you cover. And Ursula, let's first start with you and Two Strikes and talk about Mark Jones. So how did he end up with life in prison without parole?
Well, Mark was sentenced under a law called PRR, the Prison Releasee Reoffender Statute in Florida. And that means that if he committed a felony and served a year, at least a year of time in prison, and then reoffended within 3 years, he was charged with the maximum. This law takes away discretion from judges. And he ended up going to trial and getting convicted by a 6-person jury, and so ended up with life in prison. And in Florida, life in prison means life in prison without parole.
And it's pretty heartbreaking because he had a lot of struggles in his life, but it's quite a punishment. And it sounds like even the victim who was a victim of this attempted carjacking didn't want this type of sentence to be handed down. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, our reporter, Carrie Aspinwall, when she went to interview the victim, Eunice, you know, she really understood that the victim was very sorry for the sentencing that happened. I don't think everybody was fully aware of the impact of his conviction. You know, the scene was that this older woman was going to church and she stopped at the grocery store to pick up something. It was a really hot day. So she came outside to her car, opened the windows and just sat there a minute to let the hot air come out of her car. And, you know, as the story is told, Mark comes by, he demands her keys, he reaches in to grab them and she screams and a bystander comes and he walks away. That is how the scene was described at trial, and that was what he was convicted of. He was convicted of carjacking, and that, you know, nothing was taken. The car was not taken. The woman was not hurt. She obviously was scared and traumatized. But I think, you know, I think we wanted people to take a look at the law and look at the offense and look at the other offenses that are being caught up by this dragnet of the PRR law and see whether this is really doing what people intended it to do.
And Ursula, can you talk about how Florida got to this point of incarcerating so many people with these mandatory maximum sentences and what the prospects might be for reform here?
Well, I am not a lawyer nor a Florida expert. I'm a filmmaker. and so I think, you know, this is sort of a lot of little things happen to lead up to one thing being what it is. There are a lot of different laws that are in play. You know, for instance, even that Mark's previous felony offense was stealing a drill from Home Depot, which was, I think, around $400 or $500. And I think that dollar amount was a felony threshold at that time. And now that threshold has been changed. So even that offense would not have counted as a felony in today's sentencing. So there are lots of little things that interact to make these things as they are. Mark has actually really exhausted most of his appeals at this point. He has sort of like a Hail Mary Supreme Court appeal potential, but I think that that's the kind of thing that nobody thinks that will even get past the first stage. And I think that there's potentially, I think in a few years, a chance that he could ask for commutation. So, you know, I think the hope's very grim for Mark. There are tons of other people serving under the PIR statute. I think 15%, I think, of, I got to look at these numbers, 15% of Florida's permanent lifers are in prison because of the PRR law. And that, you know, some of the other stories that Carrie covered in her article are people, you know, stealing small amounts of cash, stealing a TV. There are a lot of things that are caught up in this law that I think the average person might not think deserve life in prison.
And Ursula, you mentioned there are others who are caught up in this. What really motivated you to focus on Mark and tell Mark's story in particular?
You know, I think the fact that it was a fairly, you know, mostly nonviolent offense, you know, you can feel threatened by it. He's a really big guy. He's not unintimidating to an old lady. But the fact that he didn't have a weapon on him, the fact that he had this sort of law and order background, I think, you know, it's important to know just who's getting caught up in the system. The other cases were, I think, a little bit more on the line of people feeling this is a bad guy. You know, I didn't mean for anyone to think that Mark is a good guy, but I think it's important to look at the details and the facts. And, you know, his dad was, you know, he played football his life. He was in military school all his life. He really intended to be a guy that participated in the system. And he's the kind of guy that got caught up in it. You know, what happened at West Point was that he was the victim of a violent hazing incident. And sort of his life started to tailspin into addiction. His drug of choice was alcohol. And so a lot of his crimes were crimes of addiction. He was stealing things to get beer. And so I think, you know, his case just felt to me like one that had a lot of things in it that that needed to be looked a little bit more holistically.
And Ursula, is there any movement to change this two strikes law in Florida?
There was a legislator in Florida that was pushing to overturn it. He has since not, I think he's not in law anymore, in politics anymore. But, you know, there's a group called PRR Families, if people are interested in exploring. I know that they're always fighting, and these are family members of people who are convicted under PRR statute. I'm not sure there's anything, I don't think there's anything active right now, but there are definitely people who are constantly looking to overturn this. If people are interested in supporting or finding out more, I would suggest looking at PRR Families and seeing what they're doing these days.
Well, Ursula, thank you for shining a light on this issue. It's something that's easy for people to just not think about, overlook, and really stories not to get told. So I think it's very powerful that you put this documentary together to explain the human impact of what's happening with these policies. I want to turn to you, Elaine McMillian Sheldon, on Tutwiler. This was, in a very different way, a really heartbreaking documentary to watch, to see women who give birth in prison and then have to give up their newborns just within 24 hours. It seems particularly cruel, but I wanted to ask you, just as background here, what were these women in prison for? What were some of the offenses that these women were locked up for?
Like Ursula was saying, many of their crimes were associated with substance use disorder and addiction itself. So maybe they had broken a previous probation, or they had a small drug offense, or some of them actually were locked up for just trying to actually survive. One of them had stolen hamburger meat from the grocery store. None of these women had committed violent crimes where they would be serving life sentences. They were generally at our last check-in, and we did film this in 2018, 2019, all of the women we featured are out of Tutwiler. So they were not serving, you know, lifelong sentences. So that became a very confusing thing for them, when a stress-inducing thing of lack of information. They had a very vague sense of their release dates, who would have custody of their babies when they had to give them up. They're often given different due dates because they only get one ultrasound and visits from the doctor in the prison. And so these women find themselves pregnant in this system that they don't actually know how it's going to end up for them or their babies.
Well, so similar, Elaine, to what we were just talking about with Ursula, that these are essentially nonviolent crimes that people are being locked up for and then really facing these pretty draconian consequences. And I would note that there are more than 200,000 women currently held in prison or jail. That's an increase of more than 700% since 1980. And Alabama, the state where Tutwiler is located, has one of the highest incarceration rates for women in the country. And Elaine, you focused on one of those women, Misty Cook, who lets you follow her during the final weeks of her pregnancy. And she really becomes the main focus of the film. Can you talk about how you were able to sort of identify her as someone to really feature in this film and how that all came about?
Yeah, it's tough when you're making a documentary about a group of women, because we really wanted to, you know, we didn't want to make any one of these women feel like the poster child for this issue. They did not want to be that, right? And so the access and the conversations with the doula and the groups were, we want to show how the women support one another, because that was something that was immediately evident when we went into the prison. But we need to be able to show the audience the arc of this story of what it looks like for a woman to spend, you know, the really tough final months of pregnancy in a hot prison with, you know, not great nutrition, with sleeping very poorly, and going off into a bus to be induced at a hospital 35 minutes away. And so Misty was probably one of the most shy women that was part of the doula program. And she granted us access based on the relationship that we had, that when she told us to stop filming, we would stop filming. And we always kept an open dialogue with her, because this was a very traumatic moment for her. She herself had even grown up being raised by her grandparents and had experiences of visiting her own father in prison. And so it felt cyclical to her. And it was something that we wanted to be really sensitive to. So it really was around timing. And Alicia and I just spent a lot of time in the field waiting, actually, with the ambulance radio given to us by the local ambulance company, waiting for the call to come in, because we couldn't depend on the prison to call us. So it was a pretty intense time of waiting for that call, but also negotiating the fact that this is a, this is probably one of the most brutal moments for these women, and the trauma of losing your child in these moments and then filming them afterwards. We just didn't want to further add to that trauma.
And Elaine, can you talk about the policies around women who are incarcerated when they're pregnant? What happens to the newborn? What's the policy? Where do those newborns go?
Well, in terms of health standards, there's no national standards for the way we care for pregnant prisoners. In terms of the babies and who has custody of their babies, it's really state to state dependent on the resources available and individual resources. So if women are coming in and have support systems, whether that's partners or family or close family friends that are approved to take the children within that 24-hour block, then they go to a private home, you know, a family or friend. In the worst cases, they go into state custody. And once they go into state custody, it's very difficult for the women to fight to get their kids back. And then the middle ground, which is what we show with Misty, is there are some private, the one that we filmed was called the Adullam House, where they enter into a relationship with the woman that they will maintain the custody while the woman is in prison. And then after she is able to get out and get back on her feet, get a job, those types of things, and oftentimes they'll help actually employ the women, then she can have custody of her child back. But there's no clear, there's not one way it's done. And often the women are negotiating this last minute. And they try to keep up the bonds with their babies in a number of different ways. There's a breast pumping room, excuse me, in an old solitary confinement cell. It's the size of a parking space that the doulas and the women helped create. They also, you know, within the actual, you know, first minutes of meeting their baby, they take pictures and record audio. The doulas do of the mother reading a book to them so the baby can hear her later on, hear her voice. They swap hats and blankets with their babies so that they're bonding through scent and they can take their mother's scent with them. But it's a really incredibly brutal and tragic moment that just can't be repaired. There's no way to get those moments of mother and baby bonding back after that that separation of 24 hours.
And Elaine, is there any movement to try to change that policy? I asked Ursula similarly on the Florida law, but is there movement to try to make sure that there isn't just this 24-hour maximum period where a mother has a chance to bond with a newborn?
You know, I think that at the time that we made the film, there was deep concern from the doulas that what they were doing was just a Band-Aid. That, yes, they were providing this space that otherwise, you know, they were in the room during birth. Otherwise, it would have just been a prison guard and a doctor and a nurse, and that they were protecting that space for the women, but that they feel that there's so much more that needs to be done. And we do see, it's not incredibly popular, but we do see prison nurseries across the country and things like that. So that was Alabama's hope, but there's just absolutely no way they can do that in the facility that they're in right now.
And just real quick, Ursula, we're just almost out of time. Just curious, as you watched Tutwiler, what your reaction was and common threads between what you had filmed with Two Strikes.
I mean, my God, I was a new mom. I can't, as she's mentioning all these things, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be serving a sentence like that. That is definitely cruel and unusual punishment to me, to be separated from a newborn. And I was amazed by their access and heartbroken by the stories of these women and the children. You know, like my film, we spent a lot of time with Mark's wife, who's outside mm-hmm. of prison. And when you put somebody in prison, you really just don't mm-hmm. put them, you put in their family members. And in the case of Tutwiler, you're putting a small, yeah. small child in a way.
I agree. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are just out of time, but I agree completely. I just want to thank you both for joining us. That's Elaine McMillian Sheldon, director of Tutwiler, and Ursula Leung, who was the director and producer of Two Strikes. Thank you both so much for coming on Your Call.
Thank you.
And I commend listeners to check out both of those documentaries. To listen to past shows, sign up for our podcast. You can visit yourcallradio.org. You can follow us on X. We're at Your Call Radio. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.